Rich Kimball, Kerry Haskell here, and Bruce Pratt in studio for another edition of Sports Lit 101 and a brand new book to talk about.
Yes, I will tell you that I had no idea who Oscar Charleston was. I have no shame in saying that. But Bill James rates him as the fourth greatest baseball player of all time after Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, and Willie Mays. And through a lot of metrics, and I'm not a big metrics guy. I don't, you know, I understand the way some of them work. You'd have to agree. He's a remarkable guy who did his great playing in the 1920s and the late teens. He was 15 years old. He was one of many children in a family, a poor African-American family in Indianapolis. He signed up for the Army, and they sent him to the Philippines. And he played baseball, and he lived in the Philippines for a couple of years. And then he went to Cuba for spring training. And so by the time he was 19 years old, here's a kid from the railroad flats of Indianapolis who's been to Honolulu, Manila, Havana, Miami, all these places. And he's a natural athlete. He is a five-tool player beyond doubt. But he was mostly known for his incredible ability in the outfield. Back in the days of the little glove, they told the right fielder and left fielder to hug the lines and let him cover the rest. And Buck O'Neill said it was like watching Babe Ruth, Tris Speaker, I forget the third person he said, Ty Cobb rolled into one.
Wow, that's a pretty good company.
Yeah, and as we know, from especially from the Ken Burns series and other things with Buck O'Neill was around a long time. He saw these guys. He's not trying to do this out of, he's not trying to come up with this out of history books or pages. This book represents, and I don't know all the details on this yet either, but there seem to be a spate of books coming out now on the Negro Leagues, in part because of the expansion of the Negro League Hall of Fame in Kansas City. But a number of baseball historians and researchers have become interested in facets of the game that no one had really researched before. You would see that there was a crowd of 8,000. What's amazing that I did not know this, that the majority of the umpires were white. And
really?
The reason was because the games were so savagely played, and there was such animosity occasionally between the teams and the local umpire, and the umpires sort of were known to be homers some of the time. They knew a white guy wouldn't get attacked. They were afraid that a black umpire would get attacked. We also did not know, and I certainly did not know, that in the early Negro League games, there were many, many, many white fans who showed up for these games. Now, you always see the pictures of, the Crawford Grays, or the Newark Bears, or the other Pittsburgh team, or the Chicago teams. And the stands are primarily black men wearing hats. But apparently, if there were 11,000 spectators at a game, 3,000 might be white. And that white people early on were in favor of integrating the leagues. Now, this is amazing, okay? This comes from the Detroit Free Press's correspondent of a game in 1917 or 18. Doesn't really make it. The quality of the Negro League players made an impression on the white Detroit media. Now the quote. If the American League could consistently dish up as good a brand of the nation's pastime as the Dusky Warriors put forth, the magnates would have to build seating extensions, wrote the Detroit Free Press correspondent, adding that both Redding and Williams, two pitchers of the day, would surely be stars in the big ring were it not for their unbleached exterior. Now, that's not racist code. That's code for, you guys ought to pay attention to this. And apparently, had it not been for opposition in the South and in bigger northeastern cities, Boston, Philadelphia, New York, Midwesterners would have been fine with this. Now, not all of them, obviously, but the other thing that's really interesting is that because so many of these guys had been in the Army, they had an extra sort of people had a sense that they had done something for their country. The enlistment rates of the Negro League players, bang, there was a war, they were gone.
Wow.
Because they wanted to prove, they felt that they had the same thing we're trying to prove on the ball field, they were equal to whites in all ways. Another really interesting thing I came across on that was another comment regarding the players. There's a guy named, and you see his name a lot if you do in baseball research, Scott Simkus, S-I-M-K-U-S. He found the results of 250 games played between 1901 and 1950, which major league players competed against Negro League squads. Now, this is not, you know, all barnstorming top teams. The black teams won 128, lost 15, and tied 7. The figures are a bit misleading, as Simkus's data shows. Against all other levels of competition, military, AAA, AA, high class A, low A, semi-pro, college, the major league teams posted higher winning percentages than did the Negro League teams. The thought being that when you had a really good black baseball team, you know, if you had the Chicago Giants, or you had, even the ABC's C.I. Taylor's team in Indianapolis, and they played an average major league team, it was pretty much this way. They were pretty even. When they played, if they had played a team of all barnstorming top guys, no one Negro League team could compete at that level. But if you took their best guys and played them with the best guys in white baseball, that would be true. The conclusion of which Simkus research points is that the average Major League team was noticeably better than the average Negro League team during this period, but not by a huge margin, and that clearly Negro Leagues offered the next highest level of competition after the majors. So they were better than AAA, which I don't think a lot of people understand.
Because I think the impression is that a lot of these teams, because we know so little about the Negro Leagues, the impression is that, well, every team had a Buck O'Neill or a Satchel Paige. And so maybe they all had one great player, but they also had a lot of very good players.
Yeah, and when we talked about the Satchel Paige book and about that team in Havana, which might have been the best baseball team of the 20th century, I don't know if it meant 21st century, but the 20th century, because there was, you also had the Negro Leagues. You had white Cubans who, if they didn't make it into the major leagues, they suddenly just declared themselves to be, quote, colored, right? They would go try and get a job as a white player in the Major League Baseball, and if they didn't get it, the next best place to play for them was in the Negro Leagues, not out in the West Coast League or something. Right. But one of the other things I found pretty interesting here is that the reactions of the fans. Now, we think of baseball now as too slow-paced, right? It was thought of then as an action-packed game because ball games lasted less than 2 hours as a rule. And if you had two hits, the next time you got drilled, and that erupted into brawls, and fans loved that. But they also felt this, they knew that players, though the average Negro League player made between $100 and $250 a month at a time in the 20s, which the American worker averaged between $50 and $100 a month, regardless of race. So they were doing well. If they made a stupendous catch, fans would just like jump out and run onto the field and shower them with money. These guys are stuffing money in their pockets and their gloves and stuff, and then going back out for the, because it's only two out, you guys got to go back in the stands. But also, apparently, the heckling was really, really bad. And sometimes when the heckling, they were playing a white team and the heckling was a racist heckling, they'd go into the stands after the guy. I mean, they weren't afraid. And many, oftentimes they got arrested. They had trouble having spring training because the South was completely segregated, though in the 20s, the North was pretty segregated too. But Charleston was born in 1896, so it makes him same age as my grandfather was, and he lived a very long life and ended up doing a lot of things we'll talk about next time because I want to really go into his life. If you're a fan of baseball and baseball history, we've had books on the Negro Leagues, we have books on black baseball entrepreneurs, the others. Looking at it through the eyes of the life and legend of baseball's greatest forgotten player is kind of interesting because he kept a scrapbook. He knew how good he was, but he didn't seem to be able to ever turn that into the real. He was in baseball forever, but he never became the cool Papa Bell or some of the other legends of that league. But clearly, when you look at his WAR and his other rankings, extrapolated over 162 game season, they match Babe Ruth, they match Tris Speaker, they match Honus Wagner, they match.
Was he a power hitter?
He could do both. In the dead ball era, this is a guy cranking almost as many home runs as Ruth. I think Ruth hit 29. Ruth hit 19 one year. He hit 12, but he only played in 62 games.
Wow.
So You know, and he had a lot of inside the park home runs because he was really fast. They may have played in places without an outfield fence or a grandstand. So it's hard to know, hard to make it apples to apples. But so far, this has been a fascinating story. I've just been absolutely intrigued. And I think that Charles Learson, friend of the show, said, "Weaving a story that is as entertaining as it is edifying, Jeremy Beard does the culture a great service by delivering a biography of the forgotten superstar Oscar Charleston, a man who lived on his own terms and played baseball like few others." Author, of course, of Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. George F. Will weighs in, Branch Rickey III. A lot of people think it's guys that know baseball. It's really good. It's really good book. I'd be interested someday when you read it, because I think you're going to really
excellent. Like it. Well, I look forward to hearing more about it.
Yeah, we'll talk about it some more next week, because it's a two-parter.
Great. Two-parter, dear.
She's a two-parter, honey.
What else you got coming up on the weeks ahead?
Well, we're going to have Miles Schrag. We had his dad on, Joe Schrag. Miles is going to talk about a new book called about the Imogene Pass Run, which is a race in Colorado that goes up and over the mountains. Foot race, you know, road race that has been dominated by people from Flagstaff, Arizona for years who have made it a point within their society, within that town, to be a running town. And there's some remarkable stories of people who, you know, suddenly fell ill and couldn't go. And then people like carrying articles of their clothing to make sure they still made the run. I mean, it's a very dedicated thing. And we'll get Miles on. Miles is a tremendously entertaining guy and really very, very articulate spokesman for running and the like. And he's also a big cyclist and stuff. So it'll be fun. We'll get him on sometime, probably in early November.
Excellent.